This is a presentation by Scott Ritter speaking March 1st at Town Hall in Seattle. This is a production of Radical Radio.
And finally, at the end of the month, we'll have our first Seattle Follies of the Spring article this month calling for the impeachment of the president. Garrison, clap if you must. Clap if you must. Garrison Keillor's got a piece in Slate urging the same thing. Central to their arguments is the belief that the case for war was built on obsolete or discredited intelligence, driven by a pre-existing commitment among members of the administration to a statement war in the Middle East, a war intended as a declaration of a doctrine. Strong stuff, but these sentiments feel drawn from the very center of the national zeitgeist. It's comparatively easy to take such a courageous stance under the protective cover of a presidential approval rating in the 30s and a favorability rating in the high 20s. A handful of loud, consistent voices have asserted the bankruptcy of the Iraq War for years, however. Number Scott Ritter's voice among the loudest, most consistent, and most authoritative. He is a ballistic missile technology expert who worked in military intelligence during a 12-year career in the U.S. Armed Forces, including assignments in the former Soviet Union and the Middle East. A former major in the U.S. Marines, Ritter also spent several months of the Gulf War serving under General Norman Schwarzkopf with Marines Central Command headquarters in Saudi Arabia. In 1991, Ritter joined the United Nations Weapons Inspections Team, or UNSCOM, a position he held until 1998. In that time, he took part in more than 30 inspection missions, 14 of them as chief. His latest work is Iraq Confidential. Previous works include Endgame and the film In Shifting Sands, The Truth About UNSCOM. While I don't know of an explicit call by Mr. Ritter for impeachment, he tends to confine his speech to issues in his areas of expertise. His central argument forms the foundation of the case made by these other commentators. As he wrote in an op-ed in today's Seattle Times, "We didn't go to war for sound national security reasons, i.e., a threat that manifested itself in a form solvable only through military intervention, but rather for domestic political reasons based on ideology that exploited the fear and ignorance of the American people in the post-September 11th, 2001 world. Attempts have been made to alternately demonize or to lionize or to marginalize his voice. 3 years into this conflict, he still sounds pretty resolute. Please welcome Scott Ritter."
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's certainly an honor and a privilege to be here tonight to have a conversation with you about the situation in Iraq. I do have to admit to some disappointment, though, when I landed. Where was the rain? I mean, we're heard on TV for so long about, you know, so many consecutive days of rain and such, and so I even brought clothes for it. But I'm sure you're grateful for the good weather, and I'm certainly grateful for the warm reception. I wish we could be here talking about a subject that was a little bit more upbeat. I'd love to be talking about how the United States got it right, went into Iraq, found covert weapons of mass destruction programs, eliminated them, and in doing so eliminated a dictator, that we had a solid plan for occupying Iraq, and we acted on that so that we brought about democracy and freedom in Iraq, and that Iraq served as a springboard for spreading democracy throughout the Middle East, and that we lived in an era of peace. But wake me up, because that's just a dream. The reality is tragically much worse. It's bad for the people of Iraq. It's horrible for the people of Iraq. I as a weapons inspector, had the opportunity to travel throughout Iraq for over 7 years. And, I'm not here to sing the praises of Saddam Hussein or the Ba'athist regime that governed Iraq with an iron hand for over 30 years. But I have to say that the Iraq that I experienced as a weapons inspector, and we got to see pretty much every nook and cranny of it, was an Iraq full of a vibrant people, a wonderful people, in fact, people who didn't express themselves violently, but expressed themselves poetically. Yes, there was a regime. It was a police state. If you vocalized your dissent against the president, you would be harshly dealt with. And I don't want to butter up that. Harshly dealt with meant arrested, detained, sometimes tortured, sometimes murdered. I'm not here to sing the praises of Saddam. But when I compare and contrast the imagery that I remember in my mind's eye over the course of 7 years of traveling through Iraq and with what I see on television today, it truly, truly saddens me. Anybody who tells you that by invading Iraq we made life better for the Iraqi people, frankly speaking, doesn't know what the hell they are talking about. By invading Iraq, we have not only condemned the people of Iraq to the 3 years of turmoil that have transpired since the invasion, but we've condemned them for decades more turmoil as they are compelled to basically sort out the mess that we have created. But to be frank and honest, my heart isn't with the people of Iraq. I am not an Iraqi citizen. I don't associate myself with that nation. I'm a citizen of the United States of America. My heart is with the American men and women who wear the uniform of the United States of America and who serve our nation so proudly overseas. Men and women who took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Men and women who are prepared to sacrifice their life in defense of that oath. Men and women who serve in Iraq and elsewhere. My heart goes out not only because they are asked to serve in harm's way. You know, when you join the military, especially the all-volunteer force of today, you can't be too surprised when Uncle Sam calls and says you must go forth and do that which you are trained to do. And let's make no bones about it. When you join the military, you're trained to wage war. And we need to be careful how we talk about war, because there is a tendency all too prevalent today to try and glorify war, to make it something noble, to make it something glorious. If you're an American youth today coming up on military age, you'd think after you watch television and enough movies that when you go to combat, there's rock and roll music blaring in the background, there's dramatic flashes and lights and the flag waving, and if somebody just happens to die, they get hit and they have the time to roll over and say something nice about their family and then pass away peacefully. It's not what war is about. War is about mankind killing mankind. And it's not about killing in some copacetic surgical fashion. It's about eviscerating people. It's about putting 5.56 millimeters of steel at high velocity into a human body. It's about exploding organs. It's about punching holes the size of grapefruits outside the people's backs, ripping off legs, ripping off arms. There's nothing peaceful about dying in modern combat. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. So horrible, in fact, that we have a duty and responsibility as human beings to try and avoid war at all costs. Having been to war, having seen war, I have to tell you, I am about as opposed to war as you can possibly get. Doesn't make me a pacifist. I'm somebody who would once again go to war to defend my country. But I would make darn sure that we exhausted every venue possible short of war before embarking on such a horrific course of action. People think war solves problems. War solves nothing. When you go to war, you tend to create a whole host of issues that haunt you forever, even if your side wins. And yet we have men and women in Iraq today that are called upon to wage war. And what for? What cause are they called upon to sacrifice their lives? You know, and that's one thing that we, the people of the United States, have a responsibility. You know, they took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. But they don't get to engage in constitutional debates before they cross the line of departure. The responsibility for these discussions rests on the shoulders of we, the people of the United States. We need to take ownership in these soldiers, these sailors, these airmen, these Marines who wear our uniform with our flag sewn on the shoulder. We need to make sure that before we ask them to go off and fight and die in a cause, that it is a cause worthy of the sacrifice we ask them to make. And when you take a look at Iraq, I can tell you right now, there is nothing in Iraq worthy of the sacrifice of a single American life, let alone over 2,270 of them. But we are at war. There will be many people, including the president, who don't want to reflect on how we got into this mess. A lot of people will say, well, you know, and the president says this often, a lot of people disagree with the decisions I made. Well, no kidding, Mr. President. A lot of people disagree with the decisions you made, but, he says, we're there. And we need to go forward. We need to solve this problem. Well, I agree wholeheartedly. We need to solve this problem. But the president wants us to believe that we have to stay the course in Iraq. Stay the course. He says that if we leave Iraq, we shame the sacrifice of those who have given their lives in Iraq, that we dishonor the cause. No, Mr. President, when you sent these men and women to war under false premise, you dishonored the cause. One of the first things they taught me as a lieutenant in the Marine Corps is that you don't reinforce failure. Why in God's name, stuck in Iraq up to our necks in a quagmire of our own making, would we sit there and say, we must stay the course? No. I agree with the president. We need to talk and have a conversation and a dialogue on a national level about how we solve the Iraq problem. But before we talk about solving the problem, shouldn't we first define the problem? Because searching for a solution when you don't know what it is you're trying to solve is a pointless and fruitless exercise. And that's what's happening today in Iraq. We say we're searching for a solution, but we haven't defined the problem. And when people do come up with a definition of a problem, it's usually a reflection of ideological motivation more than it is of the facts. Let's talk about the facts. Why are we in Iraq? You will be told that it's because we're there to liberate the Iraqi people. You will be told it's because we're there to bring democracy to the Middle East. But if you go back 3 years ago, almost to this date, there was only one reason for us to go into Iraq. The reason stated by the President of the United States, the reason put forward by the Bush administration, the case made by the United States of America to the Security Council of the United Nations. And that is that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction in violation of Security Council resolution, and in doing so presented a threat to international peace and security that mandated a military response. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the only reason we went to war in Iraq. It's the only one that we should be discussing because it's the one that our government made. The president didn't say, I think there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He didn't say, well, there might be. There's a possibility. The president said he knew there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. In speech after speech after speech, I know there are chemical weapons in Iraq, he said. Massive stockpiles of chemical weapons in Iraq. Now, I might be just a simple Marine who has a tendency to butcher the English language every now and then, but when someone says they know something, that implies certainty of knowledge. That means they are in possession of facts. And all I can ask, therefore, of my elected representatives when they say they know, I say, just show me how you know. Share with me the facts. Put it on the table so I too can share your certainty of knowledge. Back you up 100% if you do that. But the president never did that. Why? Because he didn't have the facts. Now, there are a lot of people who will say, well, don't blame the president. Don't blame his advisors. Don't blame anybody. Because it was based on intelligence information. And as George Tenet told us, the intelligence business is a tough business. It's an imperfect business. Sometimes you get it wrong. Well, I have to say, as a 12-year veteran of the intelligence business and service of my country, that I agree, it's a tough business. And sometimes we do get it wrong on the periphery. But we never get it fundamentally wrong. We never got it 100% wrong. They want us to believe that, oops, it was a mistake. Gosh, we got it wrong. There's been 5 investigations into the issue of weapons of mass destruction that have been carried out since the invasion of Iraq. 3 were conducted here in the United States. The CIA's own Iraq Survey Group put forward a report that said, oops, we got it wrong. It looks like Iraq, far from having massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction in 2003, had in fact destroyed the totality of their weapons of mass destruction in the summer of 1991. And that Iraq made no effort to reconstitute weapons of mass destruction since that time. Imagine that. Oops, we got it wrong, they say. The intelligence community thought otherwise. The Senate Select Intelligence Committee. You know, we have a habit, and I'm as guilty of it as anybody, of blaming everything on the president. Well, the last time I checked the Constitution, we were a system of government that had checks and balances. You know, we had the executive branch, the president, the legislative branch, the Congress, and then that judiciary branch, Supreme Court. But on matters of national security and foreign policy, the Supreme Court sort of takes a back stage. So we got 2 branches of government. Congress is the one that's empowered by the Constitution to declare war. Seems to have abrogated its responsibilities in this case by giving the president war powers authority before the president publicly stated his intention to go to war. But Congress is also responsible, especially in the area of intelligence. You know, one of the arguments that I always put forward when I would say in the build-up to this war, I'd say, well, where are the facts? Show me the facts, Mr. President. And my good friend Colin Powell said, well, Scott Ritter's been out of the intelligence business for some time. He just doesn't know what we know. All right, I'll buy into that one. I mean, it's one of those truisms. You know, how do you deal with that? Yeah, I left in 1998. It's now 2002. I've been out for 4 years. But, you know, it's like a brain surgeon. I don't want to equate weapons inspections with brain surgery, but, you know, it's an art. It's a technique. You sort of develop an expertise after a while. And the same with the intelligence business. You know, and if you're doing brain surgery for 12 years and you retire, and 3 years later on TV you have somebody talking about a wonderful brain surgery procedure that he did, but he's getting it all wrong. You're going, well, that doesn't sound right. No, you don't do it that way. No, that's not what happens. That's all I was saying. Just doesn't sound right what you're saying. As a weapons inspector, I had a picture, a very clear picture, of what the truth was in 1998. Now the U.S. government's saying something radically different. I'd like to know how they got this information. Share it with me. Let me know. They'll say, no, it's secret. You can't have access to it. You got to protect the national security of the United States. Okay, I buy into that. That's why we have a Congress. That's why we have elected representatives. That's why we have oversight committees. They are the ones empowered to gain access to these secrets. And the Senate Select Intelligence Community said, oops, we got it wrong. Well, yes, you did get it wrong. You got everything wrong, including how you did your job or how you didn't do your job. The Senate Select Intelligence Committee said, not only that we got it wrong in Iraq, but they got even cute. They said we got it dead wrong. well, the only thing dead about getting it wrong are the American troops and the Iraqi civilians in that country because we went to war, about weapons of mass destruction that apparently didn't exist. The President of the United States, not to be outdone by the CIA or the Senate, had his own special commission on weapons of mass destruction and intelligence, who, surprise, surprise, acknowledged, yes, we got it wrong. We made a mistake. It was innocent. The British had two, the Hutton Inquiry and the Butler Commission. They both said, got it wrong. Legitimate mistake. But it's curious. When you read these five reports that say we got it wrong, there's a couple words that aren't found in these reports. It's supposed to be a comprehensive review of how the CIA got it wrong in Iraq. And yet nowhere in these reports will you find the terminology regime change. And why is this important? Because in order for us to have gotten it wrong in Iraq, we would have had to try to find the weapons. Disarmament would have had to have been our mission. The CIA would have been having to try to find out what the truth was about weapons of mass destruction so that its assessments had relevance to the mission. Then you could say they got it wrong. We were looking for the weapons, couldn't find them, all thought the Iraqis still had them, and oops, we were wrong. But legitimate mistake on our part. But what if the CIA's mission wasn't disarmament, but regime change? And disarmament was only useful insofar as it facilitated regime change. What if disarmament was a complete setup from day one? Now, a lot of people might be saying, whoa, Ritter, you had me going, I thought you were an expert, but now you've gone off in the la-la conspiracy land. You're just making stuff up. If only it were so. I'm telling you right now, ladies and gentlemen, from day one, the United States' job in Iraq was not disarmament. It was regime change. The purpose of the CIA's efforts was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And they only pursued disarmament as a smokescreen to accomplish this mission. How do I say that? Where do I derive this? Well, let's take a look. Let's go back in time to 1990. March 1990, to be precise. The United States has a problem with its erstwhile ally Saddam Hussein. For 8 years we supported Iraq against Iran in the Iran-Iraq war because Saddam Hussein represented a secular bastion against the expansion of Islamic fundamentalism coming out of Iran. For 8 years we supported Saddam, and the support was significant. A lot of money was put into that, billions of dollars, and a lot of political effort was made to ensure that Iraq could spend that money to acquire technology necessary to produce not only chemical or conventional military capability, but weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons and long-range ballistic missiles, to be precise. You know, it's curious today when people talk about justification for going to war against Iraq. One of the things they cite consistently is Iraq's use of chemical weapons against the Kurds. The president says it over and over again. That man gassed his own people. Well, no kidding. We knew about it. 1986, the Congress of the United States put forward a resolution condemning Saddam Hussein for the use of chemical weapons. But President Reagan sent his personal emissary, Donald Rumsfeld, name might sound familiar, current Secretary of Defense, one of the people out there saying that we needed to go to war to stop a madman like Saddam from using chemical weapons against his own people. Recently declassified talking points show that Donald Rumsfeld was told by the White House, when you go to Iraq, tell Saddam Hussein to disregard the resolution of Congress. That as far as the president is concerned, to keep doing what he's doing, we support him 100%. So we thought it was okay for Saddam to gas the Kurds in the 1980s. Suddenly 2003, it's something that's worthy of military intervention. It's very strange. Like I said, these were complicated times, complicated relations with Saddam. Got more complicated after the Iran-Iraq war when Iraq started shifting its focus on the state of Israel. Started saying, hey, we're an Arab superpower. Maybe we can develop capabilities that mirror that of the state of Israel, like a secret nuclear weapons program. And the Israelis said, no, we won't put up with it. The Israelis said, if the Iraqis continue to pursue nuclear weapons or technologies related to nuclear weapons, they will bomb. Saddam came out and said, if they bomb us, we'll burn half of Israel using our chemical weapons. So now we had a standoff. The United States need to step in the middle of this and push these two guys away, prevent a war. They sent Bob Dole, Republican senator from the state of Kansas, led a delegation to Iraq, where he met with Saddam Hussein, embraced him, and gave him the following message from the president, George Herbert Walker Bush. Saddam Hussein, you are a true friend of the American people. March 1990, true friend of the American people. Fast forward, October 1990, the President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush, is giving a speech to the American people explaining why he's about to deploy 700,000 American service members to the Middle East to wage war against our true friend, Saddam Hussein. Now, how does the President do this? How does he explain to the American people why we're going to wage war against a true friend? Typical political fashion, you don't tell the truth. The world can't be gray. You can't say it's complicated. You can't trust the American people to understand the complexities and the nuances. You have to make everything black and white. And if the case we were making in March was a white case, that Saddam is a true friend of the American people, when in fact he really wasn't, now we have a situation in October 1990 where we go 180 degrees. Saddam Hussein becomes the personification of evil, when in fact he wasn't. But the president made the case that he was. Then he took it another step, and this is an important step that people need to understand. He said that Saddam Hussein is the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler, who requires Nuremberg-like retribution for his crime of invading and occupying Kuwait. Now, if you're a national-level leader and you engage in political rhetoric of that nature, you have trapped yourself, because you cannot ever be seen as negotiating with a Hitler-like figure. The president just basically told the American people that we are going to war and that it is a conflict between good and evil, and that we will deliver Nuremberg-like retribution, means Saddam Hussein will be decapitated, eliminated from power. Well, we went to war. It was a war I fought in 1991. We liberated Kuwait. That's what the international community had agreed upon. You know, the international community had imposed economic sanctions when Saddam Hussein moved into Kuwait in August of 1990, sanctions that were designed to compel Iraq to voluntarily withdraw from Kuwait so that military action wouldn't have to be brought to bear. Well, it didn't work. And we went to war and we liberated Kuwait. American troops came home. Great victory parades. Washington, D.C., New York. But now there's a problem, because while the American people are clapping for the troops, they're also going, well, wait a minute, the personification of evil, the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler, is alive. He's still in Baghdad. He resides in Baghdad, and the troops are home. Mr. President, where's his head on a platter? The president had a problem, ladies and gentlemen, and notice what I'm saying. I'm not saying that the United States had a problem. I'm not saying that Iraq represented a national security threat to the United States. I'm not saying that Saddam Hussein represented a national security threat to the United States. I'm saying that the president, George Herbert Walker Bush, had a problem, a domestic political problem here at home, because he had promised Saddam Hussein's head on a platter, and he had failed to deliver it. And his grand victory against Iraq is now tarnished. And that tarnish cannot be undone until Saddam Hussein is removed from power. But the troops are home. How do we get rid of Saddam? Well, a lot of people talked about regime change. You know, letting the Iraqi people rise up and get rid of Saddam and the Ba'athist Party. The president made reference to that when he told the Iraqi people that you need to take matters into your own hands, he said. Well, surprise, surprise, the Iraqi people tried to do that. The Shia in the south, 60% of the country, rose up against Saddam. The Kurds in the north, 22% of the country, rose up against Saddam. And where was the United States to help the people of Iraq? Well, here's a little lesson in political rhetoric, ladies and gentlemen. Regime change doesn't really mean regime change. You see, the United States was very happy with the Ba'athist government in Iraq. The United States understood that if you remove the Ba'athists and you don't have a plan on what replaces the Ba'athists, that you will get chaos and anarchy. You will get a Shia majority who trends towards a Islamic theocracy. You will get a Kurdish minority that seeks independence. None of these are attractive to the United States when we talk about the geopolitical realities of the Middle East. No, we like a Sunni Baathist government that holds these forces in check, even if it's done violently. And we liked it when Saddam Hussein was the head of this Baathist government. Except now that Saddam Hussein's survival is a political problem for the president, we got to get rid of Saddam Hussein. But don't get rid of the regime. That's why we didn't support the Shia. That's why we didn't support the Kurds. We didn't want regime change. We wanted name change. We wanted some Sunni general to apply the 75-cent solution, which cost one 9mm bullet put in the back of Saddam's head, killing Saddam, replacing him with a Sunni dictator who looked like Saddam, talked like Saddam, acted like Saddam, just wasn't named Saddam. It was the name that caused us a problem, because that's the name that was associated with Hitler. The president needed Saddam gone, but couldn't have that decisive engagement. How do you do it? Enter the CIA, March 1991. In an estimate, they said, "Don't worry, Mr. President, Saddam's got 6 months to live. That's it. We have destabilized him so badly, destroyed his military, destroyed his economy, that he can only survive 6 months before one of these nice Sunni generals puts a bullet in his head. All we have to do is contain him through the continuation of economic sanctions." But there was a problem. The sanctions were originally linked to the liberation of Kuwait. Kuwait has now been liberated. What to do? You need a new excuse now. How convenient. Weapons of mass destruction. April 1991, the Security Council of the United Nations votes for a resolution drafted by the United States of America, 687, calling for the complete and utter disarmament of Iraq in terms of weapons of mass destruction. Creates UN weapons inspectors to go into Iraq to oversee this effort. But, importantly, says, so long as Iraq is not found or is found not to be in compliance, economic sanctions will be continued. But then it also said, if Iraq cooperates and is found to be compliant, the sanctions will be lifted. That's the promise of the resolution, quid pro quo. A great thing. The international community voted for it, and the weapons inspectors got ready to do their job. Back in the United States, though, there was a hue and cry in the Congress. Why? Because George Herbert Walker Bush just gave Saddam Hussein a key to get out of his cage. That's like giving Adolf Hitler a key to get out of his cage. If you get rid of your weapons of mass destruction, the cage will be unlocked and you get to walk free. Well, you can't let Hitler go free now, can you? Congress was concerned. No problem. The president sent his Secretary of State, James Baker, to the Congress. And in May 1991, he said, even if Iraq cooperates with its obligation to disarm and is found to be in compliance, economic sanctions will be maintained until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. You will not find a single Security Council resolution that talks about regime change or removing Saddam Hussein, but that was the unilateral policy objective of the United States. Now, what does this mean in short? It means that the United States could care less about weapons of mass destruction, the reality of weapons of mass destruction. They wanted to maintain the public perception of a non-compliant Iraq so that the economic sanctions could be sustained. Now, this was an easy thing to do early on when the Iraqi government lied, cheated, and concealed, because the Iraqis were obligated to submit a declaration listing the totality of their holdings of weapons of mass destruction: chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, long-range ballistic missiles. They failed to do so. They submitted a false declaration. They hid over 50% of their chemical weapons capability. They hid over 50% of their ballistic missile capability. They failed to declare a nuclear weapons program or a biological weapons program. So it's very easy to keep economic sanctions in place so long as the Iraqis are lying. Now, I'm somebody who believes in the rule of law. And you don't pass a law unless you're going to enforce the law. The world had just said Iraq must be disarmed. And yet, as soon as the weapons inspectors went into Iraq, the first thing they found was a convoy of 100 trucks, on the back of which was equipment related to the enrichment of uranium for a nuclear weapon. You know, that nuclear program Iraq said we didn't have. So the inspectors found this convoy, forced the Iraqis to admit that they had lied. Now, what happened at that point in time? What should have happened said the Security Council should have withdrawn the inspectors, said Iraq, you are in material breach of your obligations under the law, and Saddam, we're coming to get you. Sayonara, Saddam. But that's not what Bush wanted, because he didn't have a plan for what was going to happen if you got rid of Saddam. You see, if you get rid of Saddam and you don't know what's going to replace him, the glue that holds Iraq is gone and Iraq devolves into chaos and anarchy. No, we don't want to do that. So the United States says, time out. You know, we badmouth the French, we badmouth the Russians, we badmouth the Chinese. But in 1991, the summer of 1991, they were ready to hold Saddam Hussein accountable for his failure to comply with the law. It was the United States that said no. Because we didn't want regime change at that point in time. We wanted name change. We just needed sanctions to do their job. So the United States said, we'll give Iraq one more chance. They passed a new resolution telling the Iraqis, this time we're serious, you have to tell us the truth. And they're going to send the inspectors back in. But they did something remarkable. Not too many people picked up on it. They transferred the burden of responsibility, the burden of proof, off the shoulders of the Iraqis and onto the shoulders of the inspectors. They told the Iraqis that you have to submit a new declaration. And it has to be full, final, and complete. But then they told the inspectors, you have to go into Iraq and search for the hidden weapons. Well, if Iraq submits a full, final, and complete declaration, there shouldn't be any hidden weapons. They've created the shadow of a doubt. They've basically said that the Iraqis are incapable of telling the truth. The inspectors will always be searching for hidden weapons, that we will never believe anything the Iraqis said. The Iraqis caught on to this. They came up to us and said, why should we cooperate with you? No matter what we do, the sanctions are never going to be lifted. The United States will never lift them. They've created this impossible situation for us. And we said, well, our job is just to implement the resolutions. We stay out of the politics. And we said, we think we can get, if you guys cooperate with us, we think we can come to closure on this. My area was ballistic missiles. Early on, that's what I was responsible for. In November of 1991, I wrote a report that said, I think the Iraqis are hiding 100 missiles and 6 mobile launchers. They aren't telling the truth. I did all the math. I looked at all the intelligence, and that's what I came up with in November 1991. In March 1992, the Iraqi government, under pressure from the inspections, decided to tell the truth. They said, we've been lying to you. We submitted a false declaration, and we're now going to come clean. They said, in the summer of 1991, they had basically unilaterally destroyed every weapon they had. But rather than telling us at the time, it's like a drug dealer. I use the drug dealer analogy. The drug dealer's got 10 bags of dope in his house. Cops come knocking on the door, flushes the drugs down the toilet. Cops come in and say, where are the drugs? And the drug dealer says something very honest. There are no drugs in this house. It's an honest statement. We, in 1991, told the Iraqis, where are the weapons? And the Iraqis said after the summer of 1991, there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's an honest statement. When the cops said, well, where are the drugs you had? Now the drug dealer lies. I never had any drugs. Never had them. When we turned to the Iraqis and said, well, where are the weapons you had? They said, well, we didn't have any weapons. We're clean, man. Don't bother us. Well, March 1992, the Iraqis admitted they had lied. They said, we hid chemical weapons, we hid long-range ballistic missiles. Remember I told you we get it wrong sometimes in the intelligence community? They hid 98 missiles, so I was off by 2. I admit, we get it wrong sometimes. But there were 6 launchers. So you know. So we go in to verify these things. The Iraqis take us to a field, and I sort of expected to see 98 missiles laid out for us to account for, but there's nothing. There's just empty desert. Well, where are the missiles? Well, they blew them up and they put them underground, bits and pieces. So we had to bring bulldozers out and become forensic archaeologists, basically dig up the ground and pull out the remnants piece by piece. Each piece had a little serial number on it. So we wrote down these serial numbers. We collected all this data. Then we went back to Russia that produced these missiles, went to the factory, and got each serial number matched to a given component. And then we put each component into a given missile according to the production records. Then we matched each missile to a shipment record that showed it came to Iraq. And in that way, we're able to verify 96 of 98 missiles as being confirmed destroyed in the ground. Ladies and gentlemen, that's darn good work in anybody's book. I'd like to see I'd like to see crime scene investigator CSI Las Vegas do something like that. Couldn't even come close. But it wasn't 100%. There was two missiles unaccounted for. That doesn't mean that the Iraqis have them. It just means we can't tell what happened to them. The Iraqis say we destroyed them all, but we can't prove it. And because the Iraqis lied to us once, we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. So we have to continue the investigation. In the fall of 1992, I lead two teams into Iraq, and we interview every single official involved in the Iraqi ballistic missile program. We go to every factory involved in building Iraqi ballistic missiles, every factory that could have been involved in building Iraqi ballistic missiles. We did a complete survey of the Iraq oil industry to see if they were perhaps diverting oil production to produce fuel specific to the Scud missile. I interviewed every military officer involved in the war to find out how they moved missiles here, there, and everywhere, from the commanding general on down. And the conclusion we reached after this exhaustive investigation was that we had disarmed Iraq in the field of ballistic missiles, that there were no more missiles left in Iraq. Case closed. Now, remember, the United States ostensibly said that its policy was disarmament of Iraq. So I come back and I go down to Washington, D.C., and I meet with 60 of the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency's top analysts on the ballistic missile issue, and I give them the stunning news. We got them. Every single one of them. There's no missiles left. Now, I expected, I guess, pretty naively, a Top Gun moment, you know? Maverick goes out there, shoots down the bad guys, lands on the aircraft carrier, and everybody's chanting, USA, USA, USA. I got ice-cold silence. That was not the message they wanted to hear. 4 days later, or a week later, I get a four-page memorandum from the director of the CIA that basically says, we reject your findings because they are largely based upon the assertions of the Iraqis. He ignored all of our forensic investigation. He said, because you accepted the Iraqi assertions, your conclusions are fundamentally flawed. Then the CIA director goes before the United States Congress and tells them that 200 missiles remain unaccounted for in Iraq. Mathematically impossible. But that number is the one that appeared on the headlines of the New York Times. 200 Scud missiles missing in Iraq. Silly American people. Who are they to believe? The director of the CIA speaking to Congress? Or some UN weapons inspector running around in Iraq saying there's nothing left? Well, we couldn't shut the case because the United States, a Security Council member, we had to appease them. We had to deal with this new 200 missiles. So I went back to Washington, D.C., asked the CIA director, didn't ask him personally, I asked people working for him, where are the 200 missiles? How do you know this? And they said, it's secret, we can't tell you. I said, well, that sort of makes it hard for us to do an inspection. You got to give me something. Throw the dog a bone. And I said, all right, we'll give you a little hint. They're hidden on the backs of trucks and moved around Iraq. Now, Iraq is a country about the size of the state of California. Can you imagine the complexity and difficulty of trying to hunt down trucks with missiles on the back of them? It's a very difficult thing to do. Some would say impossible. Well, we tried. We looked at photographs, we got truck depots lined up, we looked at movements of vehicles, and we swooped in, and we surrounded convoys, and we stopped them, we opened up the back, and there was nothing there. Now, what's that mean? When you stop a truck and open it up and there's nothing in the back? That there's no missiles in Iraq, or you just got the wrong truck and keep on trying. That's what the CIA said. Well, keep on, do that truck thing. See, they're happy with that one. We said, well, no, that's not good enough. It's we're not going to do that. You got to give us something more. Tell me you didn't come up with 200 missiles on the back of trucks. They said, well, no, there's other data. I said, well, what is it? They said, okay, we'll tell you. They're buried in the ground. They're buried under riverbeds. They're buried under lakes. They're buried into mountains. I said, okay, this is good. We're getting somewhere now. Can you give me specific locations? And this is where they made a mistake. They said, yes. And they plotted them out on the ground. So I called their bluff. 5 months later, and $12 million of U.S. taxpayers' money, we had a ground-penetrating radar built that we could mount on a helicopter. We had ground-penetrating radar that we could mount on boats that we could take out on the ground. We had dive teams go into Iraq, and we went into Iraq, and we spent 2 months scouring every site the CIA had given us. and we came up with a big goose egg. Nothing. Zero. No evidence of there ever being things buried at all there. It's amazing, some of this burial stuff. You know, we were told also that there were giant factories buried underground. Giant factories. I said, okay, where? And they pointed to one place. So I took my team out there. And like I said, I'm a simple Marine. You know, I'm pretty aggressive, but I'm not a rocket scientist. I'll be the first to admit that. So I got my boys lined up on the field, and we're getting to move in with our ground penetrating radar. But I brought in this geophysicist who was a rocket scientist. And he just sat there and he watched me and he said, Ritter, you're an idiot. And I said, what are you talking about, man? I like to think of myself as, you know, doing the good work. And he said, well, get a shovel. I said, all right, dig. And I start digging. You know, Marines are pretty good at doing that, digging foxholes and stuff. And about 3 feet down, water started seeping into the ground. And I keep digging and more water. And he goes, now, genius, let's think back to you when you were a kid in the bathtub. You got your little rubber ducky. And what happened if you put the rubber ducky under the water and then let it go? Buoyancy would bring it up. He said, now, if I'm going to bury a factory underground here, it's basically a giant rubber ducky. And you put it in there, and the water table is going to basically push the factory back up out of the ground, unless you have giant water pumps sucking the water out the whole time. So he said, look for the water pumps. And I said, well, there aren't any water pumps. And he said, bing, there's no underground factory. And, you know, that was pretty much the end of that story. But we found no missiles buried underground. We found no factories. And I went to the director of the CIA and gave him a briefing in November 1993. And I said, now we stand by our original assessment. No missiles in Iraq. I was invited to leave. My boss stayed behind, Rolf Case, Swedish diplomat. He met with the CIA director, James Woolsey. And Woolsey said, well, that Ritter guy, he's a clever little kid. And yeah, we agree. There's not 200 missiles in Iraq. He said, there's 12 to 20. And then he said the only honest thing I can recall him ever saying about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He said, that number will never change, regardless of what you do. Well, you can laugh about it, but it's a serious statement. And it's the one honest thing he said. If you reflect on the CIA's estimates of Iraqi ballistic missiles in March 2003, on the eve of the war, when we were prepared to send hundreds of American commandos in the harm's way in western Iraq to interdict the Iraqi Scud threat, it was 12 to 20, the same number that the CIA fabricated in 1993. Now, why would they fabricate this number? Because the United Nations weapons inspectors were never going to be allowed to find Iraq in compliance. Because if Iraq is found to be in compliance in the field of ballistic missiles, that opens up the possibility that we might be able to disarm them in chemical weapons, and then we might be able to disarm them in nuclear weapons, and we might be able to disarm them in biological weapons, then Iraq would be disarmed, and now where are you? You're stuck with the fact that you have to lift economic sanctions, thereby breaking the containment of Saddam Hussein, opening the door for Iraq to rejoin the family of nations with Hitler at its helm. No, we could not be allowed to do that. Ladies and gentlemen, it was never about the disarmament of Iraq. It was never about the disarmament of Iraq. The CIA knew in 1992 that all Iraq's ballistic missile capabilities had been fundamentally accounted for. Yeah, we got nuts and bolts here, but there was no viable ballistic missile capability in Iraq, either operationally or production-wise. They knew in 1993 that the Iraqi nuclear program had been totally eradicated. There was nothing left. They knew in 1994 the same truth held toward the Iraqi chemical weapons capability, and they knew by 1995 that there was no biological weapons capability. So when they say today, oops, we got it wrong, we thought these weapons existed, they are lying through their teeth. Because thanks to the hard work of the UN weapons inspectors, we did know what the truth was. Not 100%. I'm not sitting here telling you that I could give you 100% certainty that we could account for everything that the Iraqis had or did. No, there was material unaccounted for. But we could mitigate against this unaccounted for material by noting that by 1995, we had in place in Iraq the most technologically advanced intrusive on-site inspection regime in the history of arms control, blanketing the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure. That means every factory that could possibly be used to produce anything related to weapons of mass destruction was under our control. And we never once found any evidence of either retained capability or reconstituted capability in Iraq. No, the CIA didn't want Saddam Hussein disarmed. They wanted him eliminated. They wanted him gone. I talked about a political problem. It was a political problem for George Herbert Walker Bush. In October 1992, he authorized the CIA to use whatever means necessary, up to including lethal force, to remove Saddam Hussein from power. Now, he thought he'd be able to act on that after the 92 elections, but he didn't win. Bill Clinton came in. Clinton originally thought he was going to be able to change course, but he wasn't allowed to do so. There was a so-called assassination attempt against George Herbert Walker Bush in the spring of 1993 that prompted Bill Clinton to fire 23 cruise missiles into the Iraqi Intelligence Service headquarters, thereby forever sealing any possibility of the United States negotiating with Saddam Hussein. Because how can you negotiate with a Hitler-like figure that has tried to assassinate an American president? Footnote in history, ladies and gentlemen. We occupied Iraq. We captured all those documents. We captured all those Iraqi intelligence people. Where are the guys who tried to kill George Herbert Walker Bush? Turns out there was never an assassination attempt against the president. It's something the Kuwaiti government fabricated for the purpose of keeping Bill Clinton focused on the task of making sure Saddam Hussein was kept in his box through economic sanctions. And he did so. But Clinton wasn't too enthralled about going after Saddam. He didn't do much about it. He had the CIA take token actions. In 1994, the Republicans sweep in. Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America comes in, and one of the things they do is they start holding Bill Clinton accountable for not dealing with Hitler, with Saddam. Saddam still exists. 3 years after we won a grand victory in 1991, Saddam's in power. Bill Clinton is obviously the personification of weakness, an ineffective president, unwilling or unable to deal with a dictator. And Bill Clinton took a look at that and said, oh my goodness, in 1996, I got to run for re-election. So in 1995, he turns to the CIA and says, get rid of Saddam. Now, I'm serious about it. I want him gone by June 1996. The CIA is thrown into action. Now remember, we're seeking to remove an Iraqi dictator, not because he poses a threat to the security of the United States, but because he poses a political problem for the president of the United States. And the CIA moves on Saddam. They carry out a massive coup attempt in June 1996, using weapons inspections, by the way, as a vehicle to gather intelligence about the security of Saddam and to trigger the actual coup. Now, Saddam Hussein uncovers the coup. His security forces wrap it up. 800 Iraqis are arrested and executed. And from that moment on, every time the Iraqi government saw a UN weapons inspection team, they didn't see people trying to disarm Iraq. They saw people trying to kill their president. And they were right. People say, hey, if Iraq didn't have any weapons of mass destruction, Mr. Ritter, how come they blocked all your teams from 1996 to 1998? How come we got videotapes of you pointing your finger saying, I want to come in, and they're saying no? They were hiding something. Yeah, every site that they did that at was a presidential palace or a site affiliated with presidential security. And they didn't want the CIA operatives operating on my team to gain access to those facilities so they could target their president. The bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is that we went to war in Iraq in 2003 because of domestic American politics. We went to war in Iraq because the American people, we the people, had been preconditioned to accept at face value everything negative about Iraq and its dictator, Saddam Hussein. We never once questioned the assertions that Iraq posed a threat to the United States of America in the form of weapons of mass destruction. We just accepted it. We never demanded of our elected representatives that they not only abide by the Constitution in terms of declaring war before we go to war, but also carrying out that effective oversight of the claims made by the administration about a threat to the security of the United States. I said this is about domestic American politics. Bill Clinton's failure in 96 to get rid of Saddam Hussein created an opportunity for the Republicans. In 1997, the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party had organized itself into an organization called the Project for a New American Century. They put forward a vision statement that talked about regime change in Iraq and the transformation of the entire Middle East. Iraq became the trigger point for this larger objective of transforming the Middle East. In 1998, the Project for New American Century sent a letter to Bill Clinton, August 1998, saying that getting rid of Saddam Hussein must become the policy of the United States, stated policy, not just secret policy. This manifested itself in the passage of the so-called Iraq Liberation Act in the fall of 1998, where the Congress of the United States said it is the policy of the United States to get rid of Saddam Hussein, allocated $100 million of our taxpayers' money to do just this. Still, Clinton didn't act, because he recognized how incompetent this law was, but he had no choice but to sign it for domestic political reasons. And his failure to decisively take action on the Iraq Liberation Act opened the door for the 2000 election, where George W. Bush and the Republican Party said, as a cornerstone of their platform, that we will get rid of Saddam Hussein if you vote us into office. Well, surprise, surprise, surprise. One of the few promises that man's ever kept. Because they did get rid of Saddam Hussein. Why? Not because Saddam Hussein posed a threat to the United States of America, but that Saddam Hussein was a political opportunity here at home. He was a whipping post. He was a symbol. He was an opportunity for the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party to implement its grander scheme of how America will dominate the globe. Again, fanciful thinking. Some people say, well, what are you referring to, the 1997 vision statement of the Project New American Century? Those are private citizens. They can say what they want. No! I'm referring to the 2002 National Security Strategy of the United States of America, an official document that sets forth the official policy of this country that basically says that we, the people of the United States of America, all 300 million of us, get to establish the terms of coexistence between us and billions of others. That we who populate this nation called the United States basically get to treat the entire globe as our backyard to do anything we want, anytime we want, any way we want. Ladies and gentlemen, we face a fundamental problem. Going to war in Iraq has given our country a giant black eye. Going to war in Iraq has cost this nation $250 billion. Going to war in Iraq has cost this nation thousands of lives. But it's a much bigger problem than simply war in Iraq. Because as I said, Iraq was just the stepping stone for a larger policy of regime transformation. Why is it important that we reflect on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, even though today, 3 years after we invaded, we know there's none there? Because that represents a process that is repeating itself today as we sit here in Iran, where the president has said Iran poses a threat to the national security of the United States of America in the form of a nuclear weapons program, and that we must resolve this by changing the regime. It's the exact same pattern of behavior taking place. And we, the people of the United States, are doing nothing about it. Why is it important? Because if we are to survive this century, as the United States of America, we, the people of the United States, must reimbue ourselves with the notion of citizenship that is sadly lacking in our society. If Americans have any integrity whatsoever, they would get up every morning and look in the mirror and say, am I a good citizen? If they were honest, then most of them would have to say no. What are we if not citizens? Consumers. We're addicted to a lifestyle that we can't sustain domestically. It's a lifestyle that requires us to gain access to the globe's resources on our terms. Thereby, we, the addicted people of the United States of America, tell our policymakers to enact foreign policy initiatives that feed our addiction. But it's not just our addiction, it's not just our consumerism. There's another malaise that's out there. We call ourselves a peace-loving people. It's the furthest thing from the truth. We, the people of the United States of America, are addicted to war. And until we break this dual addiction of consumerism and addiction to violence, our nation is headed on a path straight to the abyss, one that we will not be able to correct. Do we want to destroy this country? Do we want the end of this country? I say no. I have twin 13-year-old daughters. I want them to have a better future. But unless we, the people of the United States, wake up and start acting as the citizens we are obligated to be, that future will be nothing but dire indeed. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions anybody has. Thank you. Thanks.
You have been listening to Scott Ritter speaking in Seattle, March 1st, at Town Hall. This has been a production of Radical Radio at radicalradio.org in Seattle.